Yes, it is 8:09, and I just want to give an update on that accident in Lamb's Canyon. Originally, they had suggested it would not be clearing until 8:30, but it looks like now it may be cleared, according to this last update. It was eastbound at milepost 136. That's Lamb's Canyon. And then also, a health department update has come from Wasatch County, and it is a health watch for Deer Creek Reservoir due to the presence of potentially harmful algae. It's the time of the year, it seems. Samples were collected and officials are awaiting test results. Deer Creek remains open. Those recreating are advised to not swim, water ski, or boat in areas of scum. Algae occurs naturally in water bodies. Occasionally, large accumulations of cyanobacteria can result in the formation of a potentially harmful algal bloom. And for more information on harmful algal blooms, visit habs.utah.gov. Just be aware of all those things on this Thursday morning, September 3rd. A new book highlighting the world of avalanche professionals is a collaboration between a veteran journalist and a longtime avalanche forecaster. Rick Bruff has more on this.
The book is called Dragons in the Snow, Avalanche Detectives and the Race to Beat Death in the Mountains. The author, Ed Power, has a 35-year news career. He became a part-time resident of the Ogden Valley in 2004 and moved there full-time 11 years later. He talked about how he got interested in the subject of slides and how he met expert forecaster Craig Gordon.
And I was struck right away in the mornings how much avalanche bombing was going off across the valley at Snow Basin Ski Resort and behind us up at Powder Mountain. And I became interested in wondering about who these people were that were doing this work and what their lives were like. And I decided it was important for me to take a course in avalanche awareness since I was going to be up in the mountains so much. I signed up for a course and Craig was teaching it. And anyone who knows Craig, he's kind of a larger-than-life guy. And we hit it off. And I told him I was looking for some writing projects. I wanted to go back to my original love of writing and decided it was a great opportunity to do this book.
Gordon helped the author connect with all the right players in the industry. Power said the book is about science, about the psychology of risk-taking in the backcountry, and features some individual stories of rescues and fatalities.
The book starts out with an accident that happened in the Uinta Range that Craig ended up investigating, and it tells, in the first few chapters, it tells the story of that accident and what went wrong, and introduces the reader to some of the techniques that Craig and his colleagues use to investigate avalanches. It takes a look at the science of snow and snowpack and how that all plays into the picture. It looks at the lives of avalanche forecasters and the kind of work that they do, and again, the kind of schedules they lead, which are waking up at 3 a.m. in the morning to post avalanche advisories, that kind of thing. And tells some other stories of accidents, some of which resulted in fortunate rescues and some of which resulted in death.
The book has been released as of September 1st. It also is having a virtual launch event Thursday at 7 p.m. based at the Black Diamond store at Trolley Square. You can go to mountaineers.org to link to it. Meanwhile, it's likely that this ski season isn't going to be normal, but Gordon said the backcountry will be busier than ever. He explained what they will be doing. He said their first piece of advice is don't trigger snow slides.
Avalanche avoidance is going to be the ticket. Next, you got to have all the rescue gear, but if you need to use it, it means that you've screwed up. And then also, you need to have some avalanche awareness and education under your belt. Take one of our free basic avalanche awareness classes. Those are going to look a lot different as well this year. And we're still kind of figuring out that platform, but most likely those will be a virtual type of situation.
Gordon also reviewed some upcoming events from the Utah Avalanche Center.
first is going to be our annual UAC 27th annual fundraiser. That's September 10th. People can go to utahavalanchecenter.org for more information and how to host a party. And then we've got a really cool event. It's a bit of a refresher, but it also might be some new information to people. Our 13th annual Utah Snow and Avalanche Workshop will also have a virtual platform that is going to be held in the second week of November, 10th, 11th, 12th, and those times are going to be from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. So you can get all things avalanche at your one-stop shop for all things avalanche. That's utahavalanchecenter.org.
And forecaster Craig Gordon and author Ed Power. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
And our first guest on the line is Roger Armstrong, Summit County Council member, and he's here to give us an update on yesterday's meeting. Thanks for joining us, Roger.
Good morning, Caroline. How are you?
Great, thank you. So the council approved the next step, allowing Snyderville Rec District to enforce parking regulations at our trailheads, and the suggested fines were to start at $50 to $60 and work up to $105. So, Roger, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this is enough to enforce the regulations?
I do. You know, we're taking baby steps on this, and we've got to figure out a way to get people to comply better with some of the behaviors that are happening at the trailhead. Some of those neighborhoods are being substantially impacted by overuse. I suspect that a lot of that use is coming from outside of Summit County, but it's not entirely outside of Summit County. And also, we've had some issues with blocking fire egress and evacuation routes in some of the areas where wildland fire is a substantial risk, especially at this time of year. As we head into the cooler months, that'll lighten up a little bit, but then we'll transition to plowing and, you know, again, providing emergency access for emergency response. So it's important that we get our arms around this. You know, the procedures that Snyderville Basin Rec will undertake will be a warning first, then a fine second, and towing for a third offense. And the fines that you were talking about start at, I think, $40. If you're violating the restriction against parking within 1,000 feet of a trailhead, and then $50 if you're blocking emergency ingress and egress. And the escalating amounts that go up to $105 is if you don't pay the fine. So, you know, people that violate the parking will have some control over those increased fees. Just pay the fine on time.
Well, so if there is a first offense and then another offense occurs, the first offense would be a warning, the second offense would be a fine, the third offense is a tow, is that what you're saying? And then there's also a fine of $105 associated with that, or is that something separate?
That's something separate. So, okay. You know, if you park illegally the first time, you'll get a warning ticket on your car saying, please don't do this. There's no parking here, and explaining what the law is. If you do it again, then that's where the fine system comes in, the $40 and $50 fines for violating the parking. And your license plates will be tracked in a database. So the first time a warning is issued, the license plate will go into a database. And if that same car is then violating the parking restrictions again, it escalates to a fine. And if they do it again, then that's when the car would be towed. The $105, again, the escalating nature of the fine is if you get a $40 fine and you don't pay it in 10 days, I think it goes up to $47 or $50. And if you don't pay it in another 10 days, it goes up again, and then it goes up again. And the cap is $105 if you just fail to refuse. Okay. If you refuse to pay for a longer period of time.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. So,
sure.
Yeah, you don't want to you get one free shot, and then after that you really need to take responsibility, it sounds like. So, neighborhoods impacted from a fire standpoint, are we mostly talking about in the Summit Park area, or are there other problem areas that maybe we haven't really discussed yet?
I think Summit Park, I wouldn't want to, you know, give you an opinion on every place that we have those problems, but Summit Park is certainly one of the areas that we're very concerned about because the roads are very narrow. And when you get, it's not just fire, you know, during the fire season and during the plow season, when you've got people parking on both sides of the roads, it narrows it down so you can't get an emergency vehicle through. And in a evacuation situation where, you know, a fire started and you've got to get people out of those areas that are heavily treed, it would be incredibly difficult and worse, incredibly slow to try and get people out of those areas. But there are other places, you know, even Rob's Trail is a place where we've had a significant number of complaints, and those range from speeding vehicles heading between, you know, from the bottom up toward the Olympic Park with people trying to find access, trespass on private property up there, people leaving trash, people leaving their bags of dog poop on private property. There are a lot of impacts that we see up there on literally an every week basis it's happening. But, you know, there's a wildland interface there as well. So I said the road's a little bit wider, so it's a little less of an issue in terms of evacuation. But on heavy days, it could slow it down as well.
Sure. Okay. Let's move on to transit discussions with Wasatch County. There was a very brief joint meeting that was recently held, 30 minutes or so. Roger, you made a few comments. You said the Park City area found here in our area that citizens do get interested in transit when the traffic pressures mount. Do you think Wasatch County will see a future Carmageddon type of situation where this could happen? You also said another challenge is to figure out how citizens can get access to transit. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, in terms of the, you know, the traffic impacts, the basin is a bit unique because we have two main roads coming in and out. And, you know, during heavy ski days, those wind up getting clogged substantially. And even, you know, during regular ski days, we can see the loadout be quite slow. Wasatch County is perhaps a little bit different. I don't know about their entire road system, but I do know that as Mayflower builds out and given the plans for that area, I think demand down there will sharply increase with the 17 to 20,000 units that are going in the Jordanelle area. As that gets built out over the years, I think that's going to, just the sheer volume, the number of people getting into cars, going to work, going to get, you know, the necessaries that they drive places to, you know, get to, and trips to the resorts and other places, it's going to substantially increase traffic in that area. And there are, you know, jurisdictions have various ways of dealing with traffic impacts, and transit is one of those. And I think, you know, the benefit for Wasatch County right now, as I said yesterday, is that they've got, you know, the challenges that we had to tackle here in the basin from a really remarkably aggressive growth pattern from the time of the Olympics, maybe just before the Olympics until now, that rapidly increased those pressures and forced us to respond on a reactive basis rather than a proactive forward-looking basis. And I think that, you know, the advantage that Wasatch County has now is that they're in a situation where they can anticipate where some of those impacts may occur, and they can start, you know, phasing in some of their solutions. And, you know, I was really appreciative that they're open to having these regional discussions with Summit County, because I think, as, you know, where we come together in that border, and as that gets more congested with housing and other uses, I think we're both going to share in those pressures. So it's nice to be able to start those discussions about sharing and solutions.
Sure. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the Colby School appeal. We reported this morning that no decision has been made, but there is an issue over, vernacular, owner-occupant residents. There was a closed-door session with the county attorney, Margaret Olson. Chairman Doug Clyde said their challenge is they've got to define certain words. Can you talk a little bit, please, about that, Roger?
I can't talk a lot about it because we're still in the process of deciding it, so I don't want to, I think it would be unfair to both parties to to go too deeply into it, but I will say that in this case, the appellant, the people that would like to operate a bed and breakfast, are concerned that the language in our code, the argument that they've made, that the language that requires that a bed and breakfast to be an owner-occupied residence is unclear, and that the language through a number of interpretations that they've offered up should include corporations and LLCs and not just natural persons. So that's kind of the issue before us, I think, the crux of the issue before us right now that we're going to have to decide.
Well, the Snowed Inn operated as a bed and breakfast for a number of years prior to it becoming a school, and so the code has changed since that time, I guess, with respect to the owner-occupied piece of it?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't recall what our prior decision was a couple of years ago. We had the chance to painfully explore each of the development codes that applied to the Snowed Inn over the years. Three different development codes, I think, applied to what could take place there, and I don't recall the history off the top of my head right now and how it acquired the rights to operate the way that it did previously versus now. I do know that a bed and breakfast, that's in the rural residential zone, and a bed and breakfast is permitted in the rural residential zone with a conditional use permit. So that's the evaluation that we're looking at specifically right now. And the specific, it's a very narrow issue before us. The Planning Commission determined that it wasn't a bed and breakfast because it wasn't owner-occupied, and that's the narrow issue that's been appealed to the council.
I see. Okay. So more to come on that, obviously. So let's talk trash. Some ordinances have been amended. You've put some restrictions on citizens who dump inappropriate items around these remote dumpsters, things like fridges, dishwashers, construction materials. So what are we talking about in terms of managing this and possible penalties?
Yeah, so we've got in some of areas like Weber Canyon, Samick, and there's one other place that was mentioned. The county provides dumpsters for people in those areas. I guess it's the Cabin Lands area. We provide dumpsters for people to dump their trash in those areas because they're remote areas. And then the county picks up that trash and, you know, those dumpsters and clears them out. People are taking advantage of that, and they're leaving large items, refrigerators, dishwashers, other kinds of trash, just regular trash that they're not even bothering to put inside the dumpsters. They may dump them on top of the dumpsters or just leave it on the ground next to the dumpsters. They're bringing truckloads of material instead of using it for household garbage, which is what it's intended for in those areas. They're bringing truckloads of stuff to dump in the dumpsters, and that is, you know, a significant expense for the county. To dump that stuff, and they should be taking that stuff to 3 Mile or to their local landfill, wherever that may be, if they're from out of the area. So we had to try to disincentivize that. So what our public works folks are proposing is a $250 fine for failure to put trash in the dumpsters if you're caught leaving stuff outside, and also for mixing stuff improperly in those dumpsters. If there's a recycle dumpster, then that's for recycling only. Because as we've discussed ad nauseum, if you put trash in a recycled bin, it contaminates the entire bin. And when you're talking about a dumpster, which is a lot more material that goes into it, it collects a lot more material, it costs us the same to dump a light dumpster as a heavy dumpster. And if we're losing a huge volume of recyclables to contamination from one of those dumpsters, that's not something we want to see happen. So we really want people to be diligent about putting recyclables in the recycling container, trash in the trash container, not putting, you know, batteries and other waste that shouldn't go in a trash container and garbage container in the garbage container. So it's, again, I think there will be an education effort. There will be signage associated with it, and there are fines to help people remember to do it the right way.
Well, it seems like anything short of cameras would really not do much. I mean, the fact that you'd find somebody doing this is kind of remote, isn't it?
Well, they're putting in high-def cameras in those locations to record what happens there. Okay. So there will be some monitoring taking place.
Okay, great. And then just quickly, there was also a mattress discussion about the fees being raised for that. And do you think that, it's going from $12 to $18 if you want to get rid of your mattress, which has to be brought to the 3 Mile Center, is that correct?
Yeah, it's okay. The company that collects mattresses for Summit County charges, I think, $12 per piece. So if it's a mattress, that's 12. If there's a box spring, that's another 12. They charge $12 currently. They're increasing that to 18. Or I think they're increasing it to 16, and Public Works is proposed increasing the fee that we charge to 18 to account for the labor that goes into that as well. So we voted to make that increase, and I think we handle about 1,200 pieces per year at the landfill. So, you know, I would guess that's 600 to 800 mattresses a year, so it's probably not a massive impact for people at $6 a piece to get rid of your mattress.
Okay, great. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Roger. Appreciate that update.
Thanks, Caroline.
Okay, bye now.
Have a great day.
You too. Next up here on the line, we have Colleen Potter, and hopefully I've got her here. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning.
Yes, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Hang on. Let me see if I can get rid of this. Are you there? Yes, I've got you. Okay, great. Now, I know yesterday or Tuesday's meeting, let's kind of go to that. You had dealt with, boy, a slew of public comments. I want to start with that regarding the old, regarding the Mill Road and Center Street intersection. You read for quite a long time letters that had been sent in. It sounds to me like it is a substantial campaign asking council to do something to address the dangerous crossing for pedestrians, cyclists, and also the very high number of accidents that occur there. So can you talk a little bit about what is holding council up, or has a decision been made that you're going to put in place some traffic calming measures for that particular intersection?
You know, it's kind of it's a unique situation because of the east side of the valley, the speed is 40 miles an hour, and then you come down right before that, and it goes down to 25. It's a main thoroughfare for east and west traffic. We do have a small area of students, middle school students. We figured there are about 175 students in that area, and our police went and counted the next day, and they counted about 30 kids crossing of middle school age and maybe 5 high school. When the council considered this several months ago, maybe 6 months ago, we did do a study, and it didn't meet the criteria for a four-way stop, and we talked about sometimes, you know, some of the other consequences of having a four-way stop there, where it might be even a little more confusing for kids to know whose turn it is and when they can cross. And so at that point, they put in some lights so the kids could push a button and the lights would flash, and that would help bring more attention to that intersection. Since then, we have had, I think, 2 accidents. It's really not a huge number when you look at the area around it, the rest of that road and other intersections. But there is clearly, like you mentioned, a campaign for people to try and get something done there. So what we've done is we've put it on the agenda for the next meeting. And in the meantime, we have a police there. We're going to have some crossing guards. We typically don't have crossing guards for middle schools. But, you know, we're just asking the council now, do you want to change the policy? Do you want to to make a different decision for this intersection than what we typically, the data that typically guides these decisions. So it'll come back in 2 weeks.
So is the intersection, is there a 25 mile per hour speed limit in that area? You'd mentioned it's 40 coming down into it, but then there's that slowdown that occurs.
Yeah, a block or two before on the east side, it goes down. It changes from 40 to 25. And on the other side, it's 25 the whole way. So, it is supposed to be 25.
Okay. And as far as, I mean, it sounds like there's a difference between the perception of those who are, putting in, concerned about how dangerous it is and what is really happening, because you mentioned just only a couple of accidents. And will, on the agenda, when you talk about this, will there be some of that data available in order to make the decision about what should happen?
Yeah, since the meeting Tuesday night, our police chief has done some research, and he's going to share the data. He's going to talk about the realities of the way that the school district boundaries are aligned. These kids don't qualify for a bus. And he's also going to talk about how every year he gets complaints about certain intersections, but it's for a half an hour in the morning and the afternoon for a couple months, and then most of the kids quit walking and biking throughout the winter. So it's tricky to be able to address that and impact traffic flow all day, year round, for a half an hour in the morning and the afternoon. So, of course, we're concerned about the students, but we're trying to think of any alternatives we can come up with and just tell the council, here's the realities of the situation, and then they'll make a decision.
Okay, great. Let's talk about the Old Mill Village development. That was in the work session, long conversation about this small 15-acre development. And it seems to be a prime location that some council seem to feel that would be better reserved for commercial development rather than residential or mixed use. Can you talk a little bit about what the background is on this and what the main issues are and the differences between council, particular council members, and what they want to see there?
You bet. So it's currently zoned C2 commercial, and so it does allow even more density and housing than what they're asking for, but it requires it to be above commercial. And what the developers are saying is there's just not demand for commercial in this area, and there's a lot of commercial opportunities in the city that are in even better locations with better access. And so they've tried to come up with a proposal that would create some housing at prices that we don't have really anywhere in the valley right now. So it is compelling as far as affordable housing. It's not deed restricted. There's no kind of subsidy. But the council, the majority, it was interesting because two of the council members were saying the reality is there's not going to be good access here. UDOT is not a lighted intersection. They're not even going to allow a left turn out of that development. One council member kept bringing up the idea of a big box and, someday we need a Costco. And the other two council members were saying it's just not going to happen. You're not going to get a Costco, A, because of our population, and B, because it's not a good location. And there's one council member Hardman, who at one point appeared to be siding with the ones who said it's not good for commercial. And then he shifted and went with two that said we need to reserve it for commercial. So they rejected the developer's proposal. The developer's been coming for a long time trying to make something work, and they basically told him he has to come back with something that would fit in a C2 commercial zone. And I guess he's going to work on that right at this point. I'm not sure what he's doing.
Okay. And it is something that you've been talking about for a while now. They've been in with several proposals, and it's just still not really ironed out, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I really think the bottom line, I mean, I think it's, we are seeing a lot. We're seeing some mixed-use developments. It's a new thing in Heber to see density like that. There's people that aren't happy about it. I also think the reality is Heber takes the burden of a lot of the affordable housing, or not even, officially affordable, but lower-priced housing for the whole valley, and some spillover from, from Park City. And so there's just tremendous demand for housing that is under $500,000, and it's hard to find, and that's why we're getting a lot of proposals, because that's where the demand is right now.
So how big of a parcel should it be in order to look at affordable housing? Is there some set number of acreage?
No, we don't have a set number, and it's tricky because pretty much anywhere else you go, there's neighbors that don't want it in their area, and nobody wants it all in. Nobody wants apartment complexes. Like, I just think we're reaching a point where we're going to have to do something different, and I don't know what it's going to be. Like, we're just really facing the pains of this need for affordable housing as we continue to watch prices go up, but nobody wants to really deal with it. And we can't deal with it in a way that Park City does. We don't have the budget for that. So it's an ongoing conversation. We've recently approached the Wasatch County Housing Authority as a city and said, hey, we need everyone to help with this. It's not just Heber's responsibility. We've got to look at a countywide strategy for dealing with affordable housing.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And then the roof sign or signage ordinance was on the agenda, and it looks like there were decisions made regarding roof signage, and maybe you can kind of give an update on what that will mean now. And then there was also a discussion on lighting of those signs.
Yeah, it's been a little bit tricky because when the businesses wanted to get their sign approved, they couldn't get a sign. They showed a couple of pictures of those. If anyone wants to see, you can go on the agenda materials. They had to go to the Board of Adjustment and get a special exception to get those signs. We had a new restaurant named the Global Grill, and when I went in there to eat, and they'd been open for a couple months, and it took them a few months to get that sign up. So what this did is it made it so that there were guidelines for those signs. They don't have to go through the Board of Adjustment. If a certain company has a certain logo, they used to be required to change the colors to a toned down colors. They changed that. So it basically was an attempt to be more business friendly while maintaining a look that is nice, and they don't go above the building, so it's not sticking up, but they are able to put something on the edge of the roof in a tasteful way.
Okay, and the discussion on color and that type of thing, that was all determined in this ordinance?
Yes, And we will soon be looking at an ordinance for lighting of signs in the night. We're looking at other cities and trying to come up with a solution for that as well.
Okay, and anything else that you want to cover?
We're still having conversations about the banner ordinance. The council did change the ordinance so that private citizens can't come and bring their banners. It has to be a city, county, or chamber-sponsored event. We're getting some news coverage on that. Social media, I interviewed with NBC News yesterday, and we're just seeing a lot of issues coming forward in the community that haven't in the past, and we're working through them.
Okay. Thank you for giving us that update this morning, Colleen.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
It's a call for art right now. Summit County and Park City Arts Council Managing Director Jocelyn Scudder joins us to talk about art on the trails. Thank you for coming on this morning, Jocelyn.
Thanks for having me, Carolyn.
Yeah, so Art on the Trails, it's a program that connects art and nature. And we've done some pop-up things in the past. You want to talk a little bit about what those have been so people can orient to this program?
Absolutely. And it is going to look a little different this year. So our mission as the Arts Council is to serve our arts and culture community by driving creative programming, providing valuable resources, and cultivating connections. And so Art in the Trails is one of the programs that we love to produce. We're in our third year, and it's a partnership program that we work with Basin Recreation and Copper Moose Farm Stand on because of the location. We've hosted Art on the Trails on McLeod Creek Trail on that section of trail right between the Copper Moose Farm Stand and Temple Har Shalom for the past 2 years, and now we're in our fifth year. And always, you know, during this time of year, we've hosted pop-up performances on the trail, and we have hundreds of people come through on one day and, you know, who are kind of happening upon poetry or dance. And it's been a phenomenal event. It's one of my favorites. But when, you know, due to COVID-19, we really felt the need to reinvent what this program was, at least for this year, and do something a little different that prioritizes public health, you know, kind of discouraged gathering. And so we decided to switch it up and put out a call for art for the community. And so we've developed this in partnership with Basin Recreation to still combine creativity and nature, but in a little bit of a different way, where we're really encouraging the community to participate, create, and get out on the trail. So the call for artists is now open, and it can be found on our website at pcscarts.org or any of our social media platforms. And it's meant to create, really, we're asking community members, local creatives, so this could be professional artists, emerging artists, kids, families who are looking for something to do over the weekend. We're encouraging them to create environmentally friendly artwork to place on the Cloud Creek Trail between the Copper Moose Farm Stand and Temple Har Shalom. And the idea is to fill up this section of trail kind of in honor of Art on the Trails. It's where we normally hold our annual event, and fill it with this environmentally friendly artwork to create a really inspiring art walk for all to enjoy this September. And so when we're asking people to participate, you know, it's important to remember that we're asking participants to make environmentally conscious artwork. So that could be, you know, the artwork is somehow upcycled or created out of natural materials. People could even come out and make flower garlands and hang them from the trees, or totem poles made out of driftwood, leaf mandalas, birdhouses made out of upcycled wood, painted rocks, which I know Park City of Kindness, the leadership project, is doing a lot of that right now. It's really just to kind of inspire creativity, get people out there, remember Art on the Trails, but this is a really safe way for people to be creative and create an interactive experience on the trail. So it's a true experiment, as much of our programming has been, you know, in this time of COVID. And we're kind of excited to see what comes out of this. We're going to be working with some of our Create PC artists as well, who might make some artwork. So I think it'll be a great surprise to then after. This is going to take place between September 5th and the 13th. That's kind of the time frame we're asking people to put items on the trail. And so after the 13th, we're really excited to see what type of artwork this community comes up with. And yeah, hopefully it's a nice surprise to see all the creativity that comes out.
Well, I'm sort of chuckling here, because you could also say that one man's art could be another man's clutter. And I'm just wondering how that will get monitored. I mean, do you have to apply and say, here's what I'm thinking I want to do?
Yes, so we do realize that this could get, I don't know. I mean, you know, that phrase is said a lot, but we also encourage, you know, if we're going to have kids participate, creativity comes in many forms. And as long as people are keeping whatever their creations are off at least 2 feet off the trail, so when you walk down the Cloud Creek Trail, you'll notice that there are grassy areas on each side and there are trees. Plenty of space to place artwork that does not impede on the trails, because safety is obviously incredibly important. But if you're interested in participating, we are encouraging artists to fill out a form, and it's a simple registration form on our website, so that we can track the artwork. And then, you know, if anything is made that's not, you know, appropriate, we are going to be monitoring it every day during the week that it's being curated. And if there's something that's not upcycled, we may remove it. And then we'll be, you know, anything that, if it's a rock sculpture, it can biodegrade and stay there. If it's something like a birdhouse or painted rock that's not really environmentally friendly, we will remove it after a period of time. So we will be monitoring it. And again, can't stress enough, it's an experiment. But, you know, I think during this time, it's been really important to prioritize creativity and connection. And I think this is a great way for families to get together and, you know, creatively problem solve on what type of artwork you could make. And we do have some inspiration photos on our website. So if you're really scratching your head on what to do, we recommend you check out Andy Goldworthy. He is a very prominent artist who does art installations in nature. And I think a lot of people, if you look up Andy Goldworthy, you'll be very inspired. So we're just encouraging some participation and hope that people come out and contribute. And I think once it's filled up, it's going to be a very inspiring walk for people to enjoy while we still have some beautiful fall weather. Well, yeah. Let's not say fall yet. We're still in summer, right?
Yeah,
it's still summertime.
I think fall comes on Tuesday from what it sounds
like. I know.
Okay, so this is beginning basically Saturday. People can start to install and put things in.
Yeah, it's beginning Saturday, and it's really a week a time frame for people to get out there on the trail. And, you know, enjoy the, let's say, early fall to get out there and create. And, again, we'll be working with some of our Create PC artists to create artwork as well. So I think it's going to be, in the end, a really beautiful display of what can be made out of nature. And it'll be a unique experience. So if you're interested, we encourage you to go to pcscarts.org. And check out the details and rules, the form to fill out, which is very simple, and join us for Art on the Trails 2020.
Okay, and that's PCSC for SummitCountyArts.org.
That's us.
Okay, thank you. That is Jocelyn Scudder. She's the Managing Director for PCSC Arts. Thanks for being on this morning.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Bye. With the winter season just around the corner and the COVID-19 pandemic ongoing, Park City Transit is faced with some difficult decisions about their services this winter. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Public transit in Park City and the surrounding areas has seen a dramatic decrease in rider numbers since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. The department is now considering reductions and cuts to their winter service that would equate to a 35% reduction in services. Most notably, the transit department is looking at cutting the Main Street trolley and three blue lines for the winter, a decision Park City Transit Manager Kim Fjellsted says is based simply on data collected on rider numbers and existing route overlaps in their system. Fjellsted says the department's operating budget was slashed by $1.2 million over the summer because of the reduced number of riders since March.
The way that we recommended these changes, we look at all kinds of data points. Ridership, you know, our experience post-COVID right now has really changed our ridership, and we've had to adjust to that because along with that, we've had a significant loss in sales tax revenue, which is a large portion of how transit is funded in Park City.
Fjellsted says Park City faces a predicted $5.4 million sales tax shortfall heading into winter. She says decisions need to be made now in order to provide enough time to hire and train the staff needed for the winter months. The department typically increases their staff in the winter due to the high number of skier and snowboarder visits, and even with the projected drop in visitors this winter, there will likely be an increased demand on public transit. According to Fjellsted, many potential riders still see public transit as a risk during the pandemic, despite studies showing when proper health and safety measures are in place, the risk of COVID-19 infection is relatively low. She says the department needs to be ready if and when people come back.
You know, perception is reality, and so we think it's going to take a while for people that are not transit dependent that have options to elect to come back to public transit, but we want to make sure we're here for them when that day comes.
The transit department has also been consulting with local businesses as the winter tourist season approaches to gauge their needs. Park City is due to see an influx of seasonal workers this winter, many of whom will not have cars and will be relying on public transit to get to and from work. Fjellsted says the outlook over the next few years is still unclear, with no definitive end in sight to the pandemic and economic recovery from this year's losses projected to take years. She says the coming cuts are likely to stay in place for the foreseeable future.
You know, unfortunately, this pandemic is not going to be a one-year situation where you just have to tighten, you know, down and save money for a year. We project we're going to be catching up from this for 3 to 4 years, so we want to make sure we're here in the long haul and responsible with those resources.
Park City Transit is seeking public comment on the proposed cuts to their services before any final decisions are made. Interested members of the public are encouraged to take a survey and participate via Zoom at the next Joint Transit Advisory Board meeting on September 15th. For more information about the proposed cuts and to take the transit survey, visit engageparkcity.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
While the Park City School District Board of Education seats 1, 2, and 3 are on this year's ballot, the candidate filing window closed on March 19th. When the filing window closed in March, three sitting board members and Peters District 1 Board President Andrew Kaplan, District 2, and Wendy Crossland, District 3, all filed to run for re-election. No other candidates filed for those seats at that time. Now Park City resident Thomas Cook has filed to run as a write-in candidate for the District 2 school board race. He's lived in Park City since 1993, is currently a member of the Snyderville Planning Commission, and he has a child who attends the winter sports school. He says as a school board member, he wants to create a more collaborative, respectful, and welcoming tone. He says he decided to run when he saw the August 24th letter from the school board to district educators.
I mean, that letter says it all. It says a small minority of you have resorted to writing form letters and doing social media campaigns. And by the way, if you continue to do that, you're going to jeopardize contract negotiations for everybody. That's all that's doing is pitting a group of teachers that need togetherness and collaboration against each other. It's divisive. And I don't think that's how you get people to the table and say, how do we solve these problems?
He's not opposed to kids being in school right now. He feels the COVID-19 concerns are nuanced and they've become political rather than based on science.
Have gone back and they're doing their job, and maybe the protections and the things that they were expecting to happen for day one are not happening, and that's concerning to me. But again, I don't have all the facts. I have sort of a feel and an understanding of, you know, what some of the pain points are for the teachers, and frankly, a lot of them are afraid to even say anything.
Cook will not have his name appear on the ballot, but the clerk's office will make every effort to decipher write-ins. The only difference in the way the ballot looks is voters in District 2 will see a line where a name can be written in. District 2 consists of Ranch Place and Snyder's Mill, East and West Highland Estates, and Park Meadows North. Three of Park City's four elementary schools fall into the district, and there are nearly 3,800 registered voters. 89% voted in the 2016 presidential election, and the Summit County Clerk believes it could be higher this year. Ballots will be mailed October 13th, and the last day to register to vote is October 23rd. Cook's press release and voting details can be found on kpcw.org.